The crematories. The last subject in paragraph 7 is the cremations. It is a big one. According to Huss and all other accounts of exterminations, Birkenau cremations took place in trenches or pits prior to the availability of the modern crematory facilities there. It is claimed that the new crematories were intended for extermination of Jews, but we have suggested a more routine purpose in the preceding chapter, pages 87, 131. Let us review their history. The construction was well into the preliminary stages of planning and ordering early in 1942, and this fact in itself makes it difficult, to say the least, to believe that they were related to any extermination program orders by Himmler in the summer of 1942. The construction plans for four structures containing crematory furnaces are dated January 28, 1942. On February 27, 1942, the head of the construction department of the WVHA, SS Colonel, later Lieutenant General, Dr. Engineer Hans Kammler, an engineer who also supervised the design of the German V rocket bases and the underground aircraft factories, visited Auschwitz and held a conference at which it was decided to install five, rather than two, as previously planned, crematory furnaces, each having three muffles or doors. This matter, therefore, was not left to the ingenuity of Huss. In the extermination legend, however, Huss definitely gets credit for the Zyklon. The 15 muffles to be installed in each of the structures or buildings were ordered from Topf & Sons, Erfurt, on August 3, 1942. The ovens were of the standard type which Topf, still in business in Wiesbaden in 1962, sold. Figure 26 contained in the print and ebook editions of this book is said to be a photograph of one of the crematories at Auschwitz. Each muffle was designed to take one body at a time, as are all standard cremation muffles. There is no evidence for the installation of any non-standard muffles, such as any designed to take more than one body at a time. Topf had also supplied ovens to camps for which exterminations are not claimed, such as Buchenwald. The plans for the four buildings containing the crematories, numbered 2, 3, 4 and 5, crematory 1 seems to have been the ultimately dormant crematory at Auschwitz 1, which contained four muffles, show that a large hall or room existed in each. For 2 and 3, these were below ground level and were designated Leichenkeller, mortuary cellar, literally corpse cellar, a German word for mortuary is Leichenhalle. Their dimensions were height 2.4 meters, and area 210 square meters, and height 2.3 meters, and area 400 square meters, respectively. The halls in the building containing crematories 4 and 5 were at ground level, and were designated Badeanstalten, bath establishments. They were each of height 2.3 meters, and area 580 square meters. According to the information generated at the Auschwitz trial of 1963-1965, these four buildings were located as shown in Figure 29. The Auschwitz Construction Department, in erecting the crematories, was assisted not only by Topf but also by the SS Company DAW, Deutsche Ausrüstungswerke, German Equipment Factory, which helped with miscellaneous constructions. The first ovens installed were in Crematory 2, and numbered, as we have noted, 15 muffles in 5-3 muffle units. The construction took considerable time, although it was carried out with deliberate haste as shown by the documents. The NMT volumes offer us the following English translation of document NO 4473. If the reader thinks he sees something in the document that is hostile to my thesis, he should withhold judgment. Quote, January 29, 1943. To the Chief Amtsgruppe C, SS Brigadeführer and Brigadier General of the Waffen-SS. Dr. Engineer Kammler. Subject, Crematory 2, Condition of the Building. The Crematory 2 has been completed, save for some minor constructional work, by the use of all the forces available, in spite of unspeakable difficulties, the severe cold, and in 24-hour shifts. The fires were started in the ovens in the presence of Senior Engineer Prüfer, representative of the contractors of the firm of Topf & Zuna, Erfurt, and they are working most satisfactorily. The planks from the concrete ceiling of the cellar used as a mortuary, Leichenkeller, could not yet be removed on account of the frost. This is, however, not very important, as the gas chamber can be used for that purpose. The firm of Topf & Zuna was not able to start deliveries of the installation in time for aeration and ventilation, as had been requested by the central building management because of restrictions in the use of railroad cars. As soon as the installation for aeration and ventilation arrive, the installing will start so that the complete installation may be expected to be ready for use February 20, 1943. We enclose a report, not attached to document, of the testing engineer of the firm of Topf & Zuna, Erfurt. The chief of the central construction management. Waffen-SS and Police Auschwitz. SS Hauptsturmfuhrer. Distribution, 1, SS Untersturmfuhrer Janischu.
Kirschneck, 1, Filing Office, File Crematory, Certified True Copy, Signature Illegible,
Es ein Unterstrom für F. I interpret this as meaning that, although all work for Crematory II was not completed, the ovens could be used in January 1943 for cremations, despite the impossibility of using the lichen killer.
On February 12, 1943, Topf wrote to Auschwitz, acknowledging receipt of an order for 5 3 muffle units for Crematory III, the construction to be completed April 10. I have not seen any documentation indicating installation of any ovens in crematories 4 and 5, unless a letter of August 21, 1942, from an SS second lieutenant at Auschwitz, mentioning a Topf proposal to install 2 3 muffle units near each of the quote-unquote baths for special purpose, should be interpreted as such. There was, however, carpentry work done on crematories 4 and 5. This brings us to the problem of the number of muffles at Birkenau. It is a problem because it is said that the Germans demolished the crematory buildings before abandoning Auschwitz. Obviously, we must assume that there were at least 30 available, 15 in both Crematory II and Crematory III, sometime in 1943. Evidence for ovens installed in 4 and 5 consists mainly in the appearance of a labor commando assigned to these crematories, in what is said to be the Birkenau employment roster for May 11, 1944, the same document that Theresienstadt Jews appear in, plus some witness testimony. The Russians and Poles claim that each of these crematories had 2 4 muffle ovens, and that the other two had 15 muffles each, 46 muffles. The WRB report had specified 36 in both 2 and 3, and 18 in 4 and 5, 108 muffles. Reitlinger claims 60 muffles by assuming that each crematory had 15. His only authority for this is the writings attributed to one Miklos Niesli, which we should not accept on anything, least of all a number. The Niesli account purports to be a record of personal experiences of a Hungarian Jewish doctor deported to Auschwitz in May 1944. It appeared in French in 1951 in the March to April issues of L'Etat Moderne, with a preface by translator T. Kramer. Rassinier has reported on his strenuous subsequent efforts to contact Niesli and determine whether or not he actually existed. The only person who seemed unquestionably to exist was translator Kramer. An English translation of Richard Seaver, foreword by Bruno Bettelheim, was published in New York in 1960 under the title, Auschwitz. Niesli was obviously dead by then because it is specified that the copyright is held by Anne Margareta Niesli. As is the usual practice with deceased authors who held doctor's degrees, the title page of a doctoral thesis, by Nicholas Niesli, Breslau 1930, is reproduced in the 1960 New York edition. The book was republished in French and German editions in 1961. According to Rassinier, it is difficult enough to reconcile the numbers in the various editions, but it is not even possible to get internal consistency in one edition. In the 1960 edition we read, page 55, that the 60 muffles could reduce several thousand corpses per day. Further on, page 87, we are told that, quote, when the two burning pits were operating simultaneously, their output varied from 5,000 to 6,000 dead a day, slightly better than the crematoriums, unquote. But then later on, page 92, we learn that crematories 2 and 3 could alone dispose of at least 10,500 per day. This is total confusion. The writings attributed to Niesli also commit what I consider the basic witness disqualifying act. They claim gratuitous regular beatings of initially healthy prisoners by the SS, for example pages 25, 27, 44, 57, it is known that this was not the case. Aside from possible humanitarian objections to such beatings, the prisoners were a source of income to the SS. Many were the complaints, on the part of the SS, against various forms of alleged Farben mistreatment. On the other hand, for security reasons, the SS discouraged fraternization between guards and prisoners. The SS guard was ordered to maintain distance, Abstand, from the prisoners, not even talking to them unless absolutely necessary. This regulation was of course difficult to enforce, and the regular and very frequent infringements of it produced memoranda from Pohl to the camp commanders, ordering appropriate and systematic instruction of the guards. Despite a certain amount of SS guard brutality as reported by authors of other books, Cohen does not report such experiences at Auschwitz, and remarks that the reception ceremony for his transport passed without violence. However, he mentions a specially constructed wooden table used for beating prisoners on the buttocks. This was a formally regulated mode of punishment of prisoners who committed various offenses in the camps. Intensified beating was defined as whacking on the naked buttocks. When an Auschwitz witness starts claiming regular gratuitous beating, he may be telling the truth on some matters, but one must reject his general credibility. On the basis of the available evidence, the best assumption is that there were 30 muffles available at Birkenau in the spring of 1943, and 46 a year later. Before leaving the subject of the number of muffles, we should remark that there are certain ambiguities in the documents relating to the crematories. The most obvious is due to the fact that the WRB report does not seem to be the only source that mistakenly numbers the Birkenau crematories 1-4 rather than 2-5. The Germans sometimes did this themselves, or so it would appear from, for example, NO 4466. The limit on the rate at which people could have been exterminated in a program of the type alleged is not determined by the rate at which people could have been gassed and the gas chambers ventilated, but by the rate at which the bodies could have been cremated. In estimating the capacity of the crematories, it is possible for arithmetic to produce some impressive figures. At that time, an hour was a very optimistic time to allow for the reduction of one body, and the bodies being wasted would not have made much difference. If we allow for 1 hour of cleaning and miscellaneous operations per day, one muffle could reduce perhaps 23 bodies per day, so 30 muffles could reduce 690, and 46 could reduce 1,058 per day. This could accommodate exterminations at the respectable rate of about 240,000 to 360,000 per year, but of course one must bear in mind that, because the exterminations are supposed to have been halted in the autumn of 1944, Auschwitz could not have had 46 muffles for more than about 1 year of exterminations. However, the logic leading to such figures as the preceding is rubbish. Things do not work that way. People, especially concentration camp inmates, who man the crematories, do not work with such efficiency. Such equipment cannot be used in such a continuous manner, and equipment needs do not occur with such mathematical regularity in any case. If we allow operations to relax towards something more realistic, taking into account downtime for regular and irregular maintenance, and allowing for usual engineering margins of excess capacity, we have figures that are generally in line with anticipated epidemic conditions. It is also possible that, as the WRB report asserts, there was a backlog of buried bodies to dispose of. It is obvious that, given a policy of cremating dead inmates, a vast operation such as Auschwitz would naturally provide relatively elaborate cremation facilities for the purpose. Thus, we again have a fact for dual interpretation, if we are to believe the extermination legend. To the commonplace interpretation of these ovens, unquestionably valid, it is proposed that we also accept as valid a second interpretation of exterminations. Below we will examine specific evidence that the number of muffles was completely compatible with the rate of quote-unquote normal deaths. That is not the last fact for dual interpretation that we are offered in connection with the cremations. Huss tells us that, quote, all of the people living in the surrounding communities knew that exterminations were going on, unquote, on account of the, quote, foul and nauseating stench from the continuous burning of bodies, unquote. If I were to select just 2 points in the extermination tale to hold up as near proof that the whole thing is a hoax, it would be this point and also the alleged role of Cyclone. The hydrogenation and other chemical industry that existed at Auschwitz was notorious for creating stenches. Visit the northern part of the New Jersey Turnpike by the Standard Oil, now Exxon refineries, or any other refineries, to see, or smell this. The only significant difference Auschwitz presented, in terms of a stench, is that the coal the Germans started from is by any relevant measure a dirtier source than crude oil. If we are told that 30 to 46 bodies being reduced in modern crematories could even compete with, much less overwhelm, this stench of industrial origin, then we know that what is involved here is not a fact for dual interpretation but an obvious lie. Actually, on account of the furor of phony objections raised by various fanatics in the 19th and early 20th centuries, cremation had been developed so that it was a rather clean process. Huss cannot be believed. The analysis has revealed a previously unsuspected but nearly inevitable attribute of the great hoax, the excess fact. Following the principle that his story should involve mostly or almost entirely valid fact, the author of the hoax easily slips into the error of including as much fact as possible, and commits the major blunder we have just seen. The story would obviously have been much better off without that fact. Of course, it is only on account of the passage of time that it has become a major blunder. At the time, it was completely effective on account of an hysterical emotional atmosphere that is impossible to recapture. Dubois wrote in 1952, quote, on the stand, Schneider had said that he never heard of any exterminations, although he recalled going along the main road one day, past a dormant crematorium. At that time, this dormant crematorium was burning corpses at the rate of 1,000 a day. The flames shot 15 meters into the air, the stink pervaded the countryside to the north for 40 miles, until it joined the stink of the Warsaw crematorium. The fumes would pucker the nose of anyone within half a mile, and Schneider, a scientist with a specially acute sense of smell, had passed within 100 yards of the place, unquote. It does not seem possible that, toward the end of a book, which gives, outside of technical literature, the best available description of the chemical industry at Auschwitz, Dubois could write thus, but there it is. It is not explicable in terms of normal errors of judgment, it is explicable only in terms of hysteria. It would seem that somebody at the trial would have challenged Huss on this point. There was a challenge, but it was weak and ambiguous. The following exchange occurred near the end of Haas's testimony. Kaufman was counsel for Kaltenbrunner, quote, "The president, the last sentence of paragraph 7 is with reference to the foul and nauseating stench. What is your question about that?" Dr. Kaufman, "Whether the population could gather from these things that an extermination of Jews was taking place." The president, "That really is too obvious a question, isn't it? They could not possibly know who it was being exterminated." Dr. Kaufman, "That is enough for me. I have no further questions," unquote. It is possible that there was a language difficulty at the time of this exchange, and that a misunderstanding existed, and that Kaufman really meant persons rather than Jews in his question. In any case, this episode suggests the utterly irrational atmosphere that must have pervaded the IMT trial. Huss was not caught in a clumsy and transparent lie. It is not possible for us to grasp the spirit of these proceedings, except to classify them as a form of hysteria. Speer was there, and he could have seen through this lie easily. Was he effectively asleep, resigned to the futility of opposition? Was he or his lawyer merely being careful to avoid becoming entangled in the extermination question? Only he can tell us, we do not know. All that is certain is that the spirit of the trial was such, that even a simple truth such as the true source of the stench, exposing with great deftness that the witness was lying, and suggesting the nature of the factual basis for the charges, could not emerge. The stench was the basis for quite a bit of witness testimony to knowledge of exterminations, and its use at one particular point of the Farben trial, to be discussed on page 242, was not only rather amusing, but also revealing and illustrative of an important point to bear in mind when reading the records of these trials. This is discussed later. In his booklet, Christofferson considered the problem of the factual basis, if any, for references to a pervasive stench at Auschwitz. The only thing he could recall was a blacksmith establishment at Auschwitz I. When horses were being shod, the burning hoofs created a stench, which could be perceived in the immediate neighborhood. Christofferson recognized that this could not account for a stench of the extent claimed in connection with the exterminations. I communicated with Christofferson on this point, inquiring into the possibility that Christofferson might have forgotten the stench of industrial origin, in searching his memory for some stench that might have approximated the stench of burning flesh. Christofferson recalled no stench of industrial origin. I also communicated with Staglick, who distinctly recalled only clean and fresh air near Auschwitz. The recollections of Christofferson and Staglick are, however, consistent with the theory that the stench of the hoax is none other than the stench associated with the Farben plant. With reference to Figure 5, the map of the Auschwitz area, Christofferson was quartered at Reisko during his year at Auschwitz, and had occasional business at Auschwitz I and Birkenau. Staglick was quartered in the town of Osijek, which is about 6 miles due south of the town of Oświęcim, and mentions that he visited the KZ Lager Auschwitz, presumably meaning Auschwitz 1, 3 or 4 times. We do not know exactly where the Farben plants were, but we know that the camp called Monowitz was either within or immediately next to the town of Monowitz, and that the camp had been placed there so that it would be close to the Farben plants. In consideration of the locations of the rail lines, rivers and roads in the area, it is probable that the Farben plants were either immediately to the east or to the west of the town Monowitz. If the former, they were 4 or 5 miles from Auschwitz I and, thus, people at that camp, at Birkenau, and a fortiori at Reisko and Osijek would never have smelled the chemical industry, which was very modest in size compared to a typical American cracking plant. If the Farben plants were immediately to the west of the town, it is possible that people at Auschwitz I might have gotten a whiff now and then when peculiar wind conditions prevailed, but that could not qualify as a pervasive stench. Thus, close consideration of the point shows that Christofferson and Staglick should not have experienced the stench of industrial origin to any extent that they would recall 30 years later. Moreover, the trial at which the pervasive stench was a pervasive feature of witness testimony was the Farben trial, at which most of the Auschwitz-related defense witnesses, and almost all of the prosecution witnesses, were people who either lived near or worked at the Farben plant. Thus, they did indeed experience a stench and testified correctly in this respect, adding only an erroneous interpretation of the stench.